Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for tuning into
Hearing the Grass Grow.
I'm your host, Lily, and today we will be diving into all things nature. The key question of this class is, how do you know what nature is and through what means? In our first year seminar, we discussed 10 ways to know nature, but today you'll be learning about 5: religion, art, science, technology, and food.
Yay!
Nature is all around us, even if we don't always realize it. How we come to interact with nature influences the ways we think about those natures. So today, we aim to help you take a deeper look, and maybe even learn a few things you didn't even realize could be considered nature along the way. None of this would be possible without
Gabriella Politi,
Lauren Kim,
Giselle Butzaya,
Grace Weed,
Gus Reed,
Jonah Shear,
Charlie Moon,
Gianna DeLasha,
Ryan Ireland,
Maya Spythe,
Lillian McGee,
Abel Chen.
They all picked their desired subject and made each segment what it is now. From the life of an industrial farm pig to the physical structures that shape sacred spaces, like churches or mosques, our stories reveal just how many forms nature can take. We can't wait to share these perspectives with you, and we hope they open your mind to the diversity within the natural world. With that said, let's begin our journey by exploring nature through the lens of religion.
Thank you so much to Lily for hosting this podcast. We're really excited today to start it off with religion. I'm Gus Reed.
And I'm Giselle. So before we start, imagine this. Standing on a quiet mountainside, the pine trees are shifting in the wind, and you can hear a single bell echoing through the valley. And among those, a temple carved so naturally into the landscape that it feels like it grew there. Now, let's picture something completely different, like a church rising in the middle of a busy town surrounded by traffic lights and coffee shops. Today, we are exploring why these sacred spaces end up in such different places and what that exactly tells us about different religions and how they view nature.
Some religions focus on the heavens, others on the land and nature. Why do you think that is?
I don't know about you, but for me personally, all the very spiritual experiences I've had in my life mostly took place in nature. One specific example I have is this summer, actually, when I went to a really popular temple back at home in Mongolia, and it was basically located in the middle of nowhere, like deep in the mountains, such a hard hike. I was kind of forced to go there because my dad really believed in those kind of stuff. And I just couldn't help but notice that the locals were just so overly passionate when they talked about the energy of the place. And most people call that temple Earth's like center of energy. So while I was standing there, I kind of understood why they were saying that. And when you're actually in that space, you really can't help but believe whatever those people are saying. Maybe this is actually a magical place that makes all wishes come true.
Right. The location of it was so impactful in between those mountains. Nature was very foundational in the building of that temple.
Yeah, exactly. What would you say your experience was?
Yeah, I would say it's actually very different. You know, there's some similarities to start off with. Churches, their windows let in the light from the sun. They're specifically built that way. The windows face east and west to match the direction of the rising sun and setting sun. That was basically to set up the sunlight as God letting his presence into the church.
Yeah, I remember noticing those while we were in the Colton Chapel during one of our class. The windows were like painted in such beautiful colors and they were like flowing in so beautifully.
Yeah, exactly. That's a common theme in these churches, the stained beautiful glass windows, and the sun comes in and it changes its colors. The sun is supposed to represent God.
But also, what about location-wise? Because to get to these temples, it's like a 5-hour hike, whereas churches, it's like a 5-minute walk.
See, that there's a difference with churches. You know, they're built in these communities and they're integrated into everyday common settings like a town or a city. That's very different from the temples where it's surrounded by nature. And the churches, you know, nature isn't really its foundation and where it's built and how it's built.
It seems like Christianity is very much more community-based as compared to other religions.
After talking about temples and mountains, I started wondering, does religion shape how people feel about nature, or does it actually change how we treat the environment? This topic seems to get pretty complex, so we decided that we wanted to talk to someone with a little more background in religious and spiritual areas. So we interviewed Dr. Hendrickson of Lafayette College, the director of religious and spiritual life.
Thank you so much, Dr. Alex Hendrickson, for joining us here today. And to start off, you've been working here at Lafayette College for about 13 years. So what do you love most about working with students, and what is it that you hope to help them discover or figure out during their time here in college?
Everyone has things that are meaningful to them. They have goals, aspirations, values. And so whether or not someone considers themselves to be religious is interesting, but it's only one piece of who you are. And so I hope that as students are in school, they're taking some time not just to think about what career do they want or what major, but what kind of person do you want to be in the world? It's not just, oh, is this going to make a lot of money, or is this a prestigious career, but is this going to help me be the kind of person I want to be?
That was really insightful, and I completely agree. So it kind of also connects to what we've been discussing in class about how nature isn't just an external environment. It shapes our values, our sense of purpose, and even the way we move through the world. So I'm curious, how has your own relationship with nature and also your religion influenced your sense of self?
I am someone who likes to take walks. And I think some of the best conversations I've had with friends or loved ones are if you're out on some sort of hiking trail or nature trail. And there's something about the conversation you have when you're walking next to someone, kind of walking side by side, but you're not necessarily looking at them in the eyes. And there's something about that walking together that I think allows us to be very honest and vulnerable. I think that can be where you really have a deep connection when folks don't have an opportunity to be in nature. I wonder if that might give them less chance to practice that kind of vulnerability and authenticity. And so when I think about faith, for me, is finding a way to be your most authentic self, where your insides match your outsides, right? So I think when you're in nature, it's much easier to achieve that kind of balance because you're not constantly being bombarded with these other things.
You worded that so beautifully. Nature really reminds us how deeply we all are connected, no matter our beliefs, whether we are atheist, Christian, or, you know, anything else.
Thank you so much to Dr. Henderson for joining us and giving us all those insightful ideas. That's it for our segment. We hope we introduce some very interesting ideas and new ideas to your mind.
Before we move on, I invite you to reflect on one question. How has your worldview shaped your relationship with nature? Now, let's continue by looking at how nature comes to life through art. So give it up for Nadia, Gianna, and Jonah.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the arts section of the podcast. Capturing Nature Through Art. I am Jonah Shearer.
I'm Gianna Delasha.
And I'm Nadia Roser.
Today, we're going to be exploring how art acts as a preserver of nature.
Rather than viewing art through a traditional gallery setting, we'll be discussing how the Carl Sterner Arts Trail brings art outdoors and commemorates nature. We'll also be talking about artworks that directly capture the essence of nature, making its life and stories everlasting.
We'll bring you along to the Arts Trail, highlighting two works that best replicate elements of nature through sculpture. We'll also be speaking with the executive director of the Arts Trail himself, Jim Toya, and discussing the significance of art that imitates nature through story, materials, and through the dispersion of ideas.
Here we are on the Carl Sterner Arts Trail. It is a 1.75-mile trail that runs along the Bushkill Creek, reaching from the Old Simmons Silk Mill all the way to the bottom of College Hill on 3rd Street. It fosters opportunities for the community to experience interconnectedness of art with nature, history, health, and wellness in a natural urban environment.
Here's a little clip from our later interview with Jim Toya sharing his insight on the Arts Trail. How do you experience the Art Trail? Not necessarily as the director, but as an individual.
Well, there's always something that kind of gets in the way of me being able to view the trail on the same level as a lot of other of our guests would. But having said that, when I'm thinking about artwork that might go on the trail when I'm curating, I am thinking about our guests' experience and how the work will inform the viewer about the environment, because most of the work that we have on the trail is meant to be a springboard for conversations about the environment, the location, the history of the location, or the community.
How does the trail encourage the college community to engage with art outside of a traditional gallery space and experience nature through art?
The first thing we think about is any individual walking onto the trail and without an agenda, who's just experiencing nature in a very passive way. It's a great opportunity for students to get off of main campus and that opportunity to just kind of meditate on the landscape.
Late Bronze Root is a large red bronze piece crafted by Steve Tobin and made through casting pieces of a large sycamore root system into bronze. It is located right before the starter arch of the Carl Sterner Arch Trail and immediately draws your eyes to its attention. Its meaning is to help represent the pieces of nature that we aren't usually able to perceive, allowing us to see the invisible made visible. Late Bronze Root is also a part of a series of numerous root castings throughout the country, the most famous of which meant to represent the great sycamore trees that surrounded the Trinity Chapel in New York, and were able to shelter the chapel from the falling debris and the shockwaves of the tragedy that was 9/11, absorbing the impact, but being uprooted in the process.
We are now standing in front of Upriver Ripple Marks Allentown Formation, created by artist Heidi Warren Bartlett, which is a cast iron and steel cast of the local sedimentary bedrock layer from the Cambrian Age Allentown Formation. The work is 10 feet tall, made of three connected metal panels reflecting the oscillations of water left by a shallow sea on seafloor mud. The sculpture is reddish-orange with rust, and only some of the original gray color of the metal peeking through. The deposit from which this work was casted is 500 million years old, and was formed under an ancient tropical ocean. This is a direct example of art reflecting nature, representing the rich natural history of the Lehigh Valley, and even how something as fleeting as ocean waves can leave a mark.
We're back in the studio with Jim Toya, who is, in addition to his involvement with the trail, an artist known for his sculptures made from forged natural materials, highlighting his more recent notes on threatened landscapes and the Never Lost Forest, in collaboration with poet Lee Upton, which focuses on documenting environmental dangers through material storytelling, and a professor at Lafayette College. Professor Toya, how are you today?
I'm great. Thank you, Nadia. How are you?
I'm good. So we wanted to reach out to you because for this podcast, we're analyzing how art can act as a preserver of nature, especially in parts of nature that are impermanent, fragile, or forgotten. So your work on threatened landscapes does exactly that, addressing different threats to our ecosystem. What do you think is the importance of preserving these natural forms through art?
So I think the most important thing, just to back up, these are two separate projects that I worked on, but it follows within the vein of all the work that I do, which is really to appreciate nature through observation initially, and then through action, which highlights some of the aspects of what that natural phenomenon is. It really depends on the different type of medium and objects that I choose from nature to use in terms of how they take form, certainly, but also kind of how they're viewed by an audience. I don't intend when I work to pick a project primarily because of its threatened status, but it seems like I often find myself in places where there are many aspects to the environment that are threatened. But I don't think that's a hard thing to do no matter where you go these days.
Yeah, unfortunately. So more talking about the physical materials that you use in your work, what drives you to use those specific materials, like, for instance, the spore drawings or also with the spider web prints that you've done?
It certainly depends on where I am and what I'm looking at. Some of those objects, like the spore drawings, I can pick the mushrooms because they're a harvestable life form and they just so happen to expel their spore after they're picked. So in that case, it was a matter of finding the right receiver for that medium, which happened to be a type of paper that I use. For other forms like the spider web, since you mentioned, those are really kind of easy, but there's a little bit more of an ethical dilemma there because I'm stealing the spider's web.
I was wondering about that because I've seen online there are some examples in where people use like abandoned spider webs.
So most of the time I am using trying to find abandoned spider webs, but spiders are super industrious and they turn around and rebuild those pretty quickly. So if I do find a really amazing spider web, I might chase the spider off and apologize. I do apologize to the spider. And then I take that web and I won't go back to that spider. That spider will build the exact same web in the exact same spot. And I found that really remarkable. But out of respect to that too, and the animal, I would not go back and ruin that lair again.
We were interested in also asking you, like, for using the materials that you do, taking the physical things from nature and incorporating them into your art, how did you get to that point? What kind of like inspired you to start taking those elements?
Poverty. Being a young artist who didn't have a lot of money to spend on expensive oil paints or, you know, that was part of it. I'm saying that a little bit in jest. Certainly in terms of finding materials to use, I would do a lot of dumpster diving or foraging in the woods for pieces of wood that I found really interesting that were lying on the ground. Or dead trees, for that matter, that I would eventually cut down. And it turned from being someone who just found a bunch of different types of objects. They had history to them. I found that those objects and their histories were informative in my creative process. So I wasn't starting with a blank canvas. I was starting with an object that already had a history to it.
Interesting. I'm back in the studio, joined again by my art co-hosts, Gianna and Jonah, here to talk more about our own insights on the Arts Trail, the interview with Professor Toya, and other reflections on why we preserve nature through art.
Yeah, and I thought that was a really insightful interview, and it made me think more about the works that we visited on the trail. Like you mentioned, some of the pieces are chosen for their historical connection to the community, and I think that's really true of Upriver Ripple Marks, which I discussed, and people are really seeing a real piece of geographical history without having to actually visit the formation themselves. And it really gets you thinking about how the land has changed and evolved over time. And that formation might not stand out to anyone, but by preserving it through art, you're kind of bringing to attention like the land's history to anyone passing through the trail. And then again, with Late Bronze Root, you're seeing a piece of nature that's usually underground. You might not otherwise see it. So you're kind of showing an appreciation for nature's importance in our lives in these unseen ways.
Yeah, I found it interesting, just kind of what you said with showing what's otherwise invisible. Also with the cast of the ocean floor, how normally that's normally covered or you don't see it. Right. Same with Bronze Root. And also talking about the material specifically,
Early in the interview, I asked questions about the spiderwebs and mushrooms because of the reading we originally did in class, which was Pieces of Nature Preserved as Art at the New Jersey State Museum by Tammy Lugors. And just how, like, in traditional storytelling through art, you're taught with traditional materials like charcoal, paint, stamp, like reliefs, paintings done with inks and whatnot. And just seeing how through Toya's work and also through other artists in the industry, instead of demonstrating this activism for the environment through simply the storytelling of their art, they're bringing it in with the physical materials. So it's not just the story that's being told by the art, but it's the physical makeup of the art itself.
Yeah. I feel like I agree with what all you guys are saying. The nature is really meant to represent the preservation and like a reminder of nature. For example, the late bronze root, it definitely represents the things that are invisible, making it visible. But I also think it represents that humans have destroyed nature in order to preserve their own things. We recreated the root system from down below because that was knocked over from a great tragedy caused by humans, which was 9/11. But we destroyed that nature and we're like, oh, it was a great miracle to save our own hide. I feel like we should be treating the destruction of nature around us with the same terrible implications of like if we destroyed our own buildings. Those were there before us. They would have been there after us, but we ended that cycle. And with ripples, that is a vision of the past that we wouldn't be able to see otherwise without this piece of art. It's something that changes, as nature always is. It's fluctuating, creating new patterns on the bottom of this river, but we have forever cemented that in metal so that people who are walking down that trail can see it. And I think that's something beautiful that we've done.
Yeah.
And that's all for this segment. Thanks for joining us today. And we'll hand you off now to our wonderful host, Lily, to bring you guys into the next segment of the podcast.
Thank you so much, Nadia, Jonah, and Gianna. I almost forgot I was only listening with how vivid your imagery was. Wow, I mean, I never realized you could create art out of so many different mediums like mushrooms or spider webs, hopefully abandoned. I can't wait to check out the Carl Sterner Arts Trail and get a look at all this artwork for myself now. Thank you so much again, and let's give it away for Lauren and Maya, who will be discussing technology.
Hi, I'm Lauren.
And I'm Maya.
And we are from the 10 Ways to Know Nature first year seminar class.
Today, we'll be talking about how technology impacts nature, but more specifically through media, artificial intelligence, and screens, and how it causes a negative and positive effect on our environment.
So first, we wanted to talk about the timeline of technology. So in 1950, we know that the dial phones were the only things that were around. There were no screens, and phone lines became prevalent, and you could only hear others through conversation.
Yeah, and then in 1996, flip phones were invented with a small screen, and just, mm-hmm. like, it just showed the numbers. And then I can even remember, like, when flip phones were around, because I know my own parents had them. And during that time, like, phones weren't as addictive, and I just know for a fact they weren't, like, attached to your hip.
Similarly, in the early 2000s, you were able to access the internet from almost anywhere, but it was still relatively new to everybody. And in 2007, when the first Apple phone was invented with the full screen, people were shocked about it. It only cost $500.
Yeah. And then moving into 2020, which I know we were both in like the seventh grade mm-hmm. for that COVID year. Yes. That's when we started becoming heavily reliant on technology, especially for learning for us, because that was the only way to communicate during that time as we were all in lockdown.
Yes.
And then in April of 2021, most parents reported that their kids' screen time was on a rise, and 72% of K through 12 parents said that their children was actually spending more time in front of their screens than they did before the outbreak, and that's when addiction really started to become like more prevalent.
I agree. Yeah, it was a big jump from early 2020, and I feel like that is why now in 2025, people are still very reliant on it. And I feel that AI is being incorporated into certain platforms such as Snapchat and Instagram, and so we know that it wouldn't really get any better from here.
All right, switching gears, I know like from personal experience in Professor Cohen's class, we were asked to watch a live stream for like around 5 minutes. He said no interruptions, no breaks, and no distractions. So I personally picked the coral reef one. I know like other people have picked like the gorilla, like the just stream, but during like my time watching it, I just saw like fish. I even saw a shark. It was pretty cool, actually.
Wow.
Yeah. And the camera just like swiveled back and forth. So when I brought my notes into class the next day, we just talked about how like these websites really do have positives and negatives within them. As we talked about how this is like a great way to keep the environment safe for the fish, and no people like will want to go see it firsthand as they can watch it right on the screen at any time of the day. But this also brought up the idea that many individuals are now going to want to see it in person and see the beauty of this ocean for themselves, like through their own eyes. As we were talking more about like the positive effects in class, I couldn't help to like mention that this is a great way to view nature positively, but inserting this camera into the coral reef must have heavily messed with the ecosystem and the natural habitat that was already put into place. What was your experience like?
I know that your experience was through a video, but mine was writing a paper. So this was a writing project with the title Technological Mediation. I had to report and analyze an experience I had 3 times, and each time I had that experience using a different technology. So I can refer this writing project back to my podcast on technology to share how my vision of landscape and nature very much differs from incorporating headphones while viewing the beach and how that sets off a different vibe as opposed to me fully being there in the moment. And I feel that this is a good way for me to express my feelings towards technology and nature because this project is a great example of how they can intertwine with one another. All right, now to move on to the interview questions. We just wanted to get an outside perspective by coming across a bunch of people on campus. So the first question was, how often do you rely on AI?
I feel like I rely on AI about 50% of the time to look stuff up.
I'd say probably a few times a week.
What the hell, bro?
I use it to like quiz myself for class.
I don't really use AI. A lot of my professors are against using ChatGPT. I only use it really if I want to like check a fact or something.
2 is, do you think it has taken a toll on how we view the outside world?
Yes, because I think it gives people easier access to information that may not be factual.
I think so. I've definitely had to research less. Sometimes if I don't find the answer, I'll just be like, oh, whatever. I'll just, you know, ChatGPT it.
Question 3 is, when was the last time you enjoyed nature for its beauty and not for its aesthetics?
This is embarrassing. Probably August. I went on a hike in Jersey. The times I am able to be out in nature, I'm like, oh, I want to document it all because this never happened. Yes. So I'm always like on my phone thinking like, oh, you know, like what can I post on my Instagram story? Like what can I show my friends to show that I do go outside?
I would say probably a week ago when I went for a walk.
Oh my gosh. It's gotta be my childhood.
Oh, hell.
I mean, never really thought about that as of recently.
Listening back to all of these responses, it's sad to hear how much technology has taken over individuals' lives.
Yes, especially the one response where she said she hasn't viewed nature for its beauty since her childhood. It was almost a filter that prohibited her from exploring the world she had when she was young.
Even hearing about the upped usage of AI is interesting to hear about because we used to reach for Google when we needed an answer and do research. Now people are getting an answer within seconds that might not even be factual.
Exactly.
Now that we have a recap of people's responses to our interview questions,
I say it's like a good time now to get in the positives and negatives of technology in nature. Mm-hmm. I know specifically like locally there's a warehouse trying to be put into like Easton, like Wilson area, and it's going to have huge effects on the air quality, flooding, and traffic. It's said in the article titled After Marathon Meeting, Vote on Controversial Easton Commerce Park Warehouse Pushed to July, that around 232 trucks would be going in there every single day. And with these trucks, of course, they're diesel. Asthma's huge in this area, and with the extra air pollution, it's going to lead to risks of like lung cancer and cardiovascular problems that are also going to damage the immune system. And since we are in the Lehigh Valley, air gets trapped in here and there's basically no escape. But going straight off of that, I know the effects of AI has caused an impact on larger world issues. I know that AI is having effects on fossil fuels and the mass amounts it uses. as well as data centers being inputted more frequently to bear the upkeep of AI. I mean, the amount of energy AI is using in one training for a supercomputer amounts to the energy of 100 homes per year. Like, that's absolutely insane. I also know that it can emit CO2 into the air depending on the electricity being used, and I know for a fact that there has been a large consumption of energy, so there's probably a lot of CO2 in the air.
I totally agree. Even though we talked a lot about the negative impacts that AI has on our environment, I want to talk about the positive effects to leave it on a strong note. AI positively affects nature by aiding in conservation efforts like wildlife monitoring and helping to manage resources like more efficiently. AI also keeps people up to date on weather conditions, such as natural disasters like hurricanes, flash flooding, and wildfires. AI systems monitor soil moisture and other factors to optimize irrigation and fertilizer use, which will eventually increase crop yields and reduce waste.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, both positive and negative effects come hand in hand. Yes. Once again.
We just wanted to take a moment and recognize everyone who actively participated in our interview. So thank you to all of them. Once again, I'm Maya.
I'm Lauren. And thank you for listening.
What's up, guys? Hello and welcome to the Science and Nature segment. Bow, 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 bow. We'd like to thank our classmates and teacher for making this podcast possible. Big shout out to Lauren and Maya for the insightful segment on technology. To introduce ourselves, we're freshmen at Lafayette College. I'm Grace, and I'm studying chemical engineering.
I'm Abel, and I'm studying physics.
And I'm Charlie, and I'm also studying chemical engineering.
Today, we're going to discuss the relationship and impact of science on nature and why the human race feels the need to understand everything, which I don't understand, but we'll get to that, as well as why do we funnel so much time, energy, and our resources into the discovery when there are so many bigger problems to solve.
Yeah, exactly. And I just want to bring up a conversation that me, Abel, and Grace had the other day about like which science we think is the most important. And me and Abel were like, you know what? I like physics the best. Like, I want to understand what happens in the universe and why all that happens. And then Grace chimed in and is like, I think that nothing matters.
I don't not believe in certain sciences. Like, I'm not like a Scientologist. Like, don't paint me out to be this like brick, but I do think that there are some sciences that are just more important. Like, as a chemical engineer, there's no way you're sitting here and just absolutely sucking up to physics. Like, you are a chemical engineer.
Chill out.
But, like, I'm saying, like, why do I need to know the gravitational constant of like 9.28?
No, you got it all wrong. It should be 9.81.
But that's what I'm saying. Like,
calm down, guys.
I'm not orbiting in space right now. I don't need to know it like the back of my hand to understand that I'm still on Earth.
Grace, enough. Like, enough.
I think this needs to be discussed. Why do you feel the need to know all of this? It doesn't make sense. It doesn't matter.
Grace, I understand both sides. Not really. I only understand Abel's side of this.
All right.
But you know what? I have an idea. Grace, settle this debate for us. Go find someone on the quad. Ask them questions you need to ask, and let's see what they think.
All right, guys. I'm back. I'm walking on the quad right now trying to see if anyone is willing to do an interview. All right, guys. I'm here with Emily, a freshman environmental science major at Lafayette. My first question for Emily is, chemistry or physics? All right. No, you don't have to answer that. I'm joking. You don't know what I'm referring to, but if you listen to the podcast, then you'll find out. Never a bad time for a shameless plug. My actual first question for you is, do you think nature benefits from modern scientific practices?
I definitely do think nature benefits from modern scientific practices. One example would be GMOs, which is genetically modified organisms. For example, golden rice. So golden rice was a genetically modified rice to have substantial amounts of vitamin A, and this would be helpful for countries that with children that lack vitamin A and have vitamin A deficiencies, which leads to blindness and then leads to sometimes death. So genetically modifying foods, which is a modern scientific practice, can also be very, very helpful to populations with that don't live in the global north. And I really do think that nature benefits from modern scientific practices, but it's not always the other way around.
All right. And my final question for you is, do you think we invest too much into research of far-fetched unknowns?
I definitely do think we invest too much into research for unknowns. And I think it's a big issue. I mean, I think we should work on what's happening on Earth right now in our people. Like, there's homelessness, there's food deserts, there's so many different things of issues that are happening on our planet with our people. And I think we should focus more on that than if there are aliens or the Loch Ness Monster.
All right, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, guys, we're back in the studio. What do we think?
I think she hit the nail on the head with that interview. She really found a great way to balance science and nature.
Yeah, I really like her point about focusing on the thing we can control.
Yeah. And all right, so back to our class, back to our discussion. Do you guys remember the Sonnet to Science by Edgar Allan Poe, that poem?
Yeah, I know. I'm glad you brought that up because Edgar Allan Poe speak about how science is important and mystery hold the same weights.
Yeah, I think Poe does a really good job, and I kind of agree with him that science is very important, but so is our imagination and our artistic expression. I think he would agree when I say the beauty is in the unknown and the mystery of the world. And I think we kind of agree, so I'm basically Edgar Allan Poe.
Yeah, well, I guess mysteries aren't always such a bad thing.
I told you so.
Oh, chill out. So, like, why do we feel the need to understand everything? Like, this is a big question. Sometimes us humans, we think that we're the center of the universe and we need to uncover all of life's secrets. But in reality, humans are pretty insignificant on the scope of the whole universe. And I found this great audio clip from famous astrophysicist Carl Sagan, and he unpacks it really well. So let's see what he has to say about our place in the universe.
I mean, here we are like mites on a plum. And the plum is this little planet, and it goes around an insignificant local star, the Sun. And that star is on the obscure outskirts of an ordinary galaxy, the Milky Way, which contains 400 billion other stars. And this galaxy is just one of something like 100 billion other galaxies.
So basically what I'm hearing is that we don't matter.
But what the hell, boy?
Why do we try so hard to understand everything when we should just worry about quality of life? Making everyone happy and healthy, I feel like that's much more important. A point I wanted to actually bring up was, I don't know if you guys went to this talk, but Gwen Ottinger actually visited Lafayette and she had a talk about reparative science. And she really spoke about, and a quote that I really like was, proof over improvement. We don't need to understand everything, but when we do, we so often don't do anything with that knowledge. And I really think this entire debate is just about the priorities of what we need to focus on first and not what's so important.
I totally agree with what Grace said, but I had held a different opinion about this club. Science is a part of human discovery, and humans' desire drives every form of human production. This is something deeply ingrained in human nature. In the scale of the universe, the existence of humanity is almost insignificant. Yet for us, the universe carries immense meaning. Compared with other animals, we are extraordinarily lucky. Natural selection granted humans the unique ability to explore everything around us. From this perspective, should we abandon the gifts of thought that nature has given us and refuse to explore? Or should we follow the path shaped by nature and continue developing peacefully with it, guided by our own understanding and responsibility? After all, we are a part of nature, so why should we feel ashamed of the very ability that nature has played within us?
Whoa, that's deep as
To switch it up a little bit, we got an interview with Lafayette's very own from the biology department, the bird man, the myth, the legend, Professor Butler. Take it away, Charlie.
All right, guys. I'm currently on the third floor of RISC, about to walk into Professor Butler's office to interview him in his natural habitat. Hello, Professor Butler. Can you tell us a little bit about your research that you do here?
Sure. So I do a mix of field and lab work. My field work takes place with
mostly, actually entirely birds at this point, and mostly cavity nesting birds. I work with house sparrows. A lot of my work is done up at Metzger, where birds can nest freely in boxes we provide, and then we can monitor their behavior, their physiology, and sometimes we can manipulate the environment to some extent to see how they respond to those changes.
How do you tie in nature into your research and your teachings?
Yeah, so out in the field, I've had to think about what nature truly means, and I've shifted a bit over the years, and now I think about nature as whatever animals might come into contact with while they're living their lives, and that now includes they interact with trash and people. Thinking about what nature means has shifted for me over the years, and now I think it's whatever's outside.
So does that make trash part of nature now?
I think it is now.
You think so?
I mean, it depends. You want to get into semantics, is it natural or not? Like, I mean, it's man-made, human-made.
Yeah.
But it is now part of our ecosystem.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's an interesting thought.
Yeah, I don't know if there are any spots that are truly untouched by people at this point.
Yeah.
Mariana Trench to, you know, upper stratosphere. You can find people-made crap everywhere.
Yeah. Okay. And then, what is the importance of understanding nature as a whole as a biologist?
Yeah, I mean, you know, biologists in general, we study life and how life operates and how it works and what it means and all that. And if this is the world in which we live, we have to acknowledge that, in my opinion.
Okay. Just one last question. This is kind of like our big picture question.
Sure.
Do you believe that there's a threshold or capacity to how much we should learn? And do you believe that there's some things that, like science related, some things that should be left a mystery?
No.
No?
Not really. There's limits to what we can learn.
Mm-hmm.
I would say
definitely
that might exist. But kind of within the realm of what tools we have, yeah, let's keep learning.
Dang, he firmly believes in scientific discovery.
Wow, I like how he agreed with me.
All right, whatever.
He's on Abel and I's side, Grace. It's okay.
I don't know. I feel crazy when I'm talking to you guys because I just feel like mystery makes life, like, so whimsical and magical. Like, I know that sounds cliche, but we don't know why we're here. We kind of know how we got here, but not enough to where we know everything. And I don't feel like we should try and reach that point. I think not knowing everything is what makes life worth living.
I see your point. And all jokes aside, I truly believe that there are two sides to this debate. One side is not better than the other. It's just like there's two different perspectives and you can't compare the two of them.
I don't think there will ever be an answer to our question about, do we actually need to know everything? Do we need to stop scientific research and discovery to focus on other things? It's just a matter of perspective and what you actually prioritize in your own life. And even though it's fun arguing with you guys, I think that we all know that there's really no answer to our question.
Yeah, I mean, I still hold my point that the desire of exploration is one of the fundamental aspects of human nature. As human as a whole, we need to accept what we have to continue learning, studying, and exploring through knowledge, guidance, and examination.
So are you saying I'm not a human because I don't believe in
Grace, that's not what he's saying. Anyway. Guys, that's going to wrap it up for today. I hope you all enjoyed it. We'd like to thank our classmates, teachers, interviewees, and the library sound staff for making this podcast possible. And once again, I'm Charlie.
I'm Abel.
And I'm Grace. And we will see you next time.
Whoa. There was a lot of tension in the beginning between the three of you. I was honestly worried I should call a mediator, but I totally understand both sides of your debate. On one hand, Grace claims physics is meaningless because it's not really necessary for our daily lives. Like, when was the last time you actually calculated the velocity at the grocery store? But on the other hand, Charlie and Abel disagree, arguing that it's important to understand the universe, even when it doesn't help you find, say, your car keys. Thank you so much, Grace, Abel, and Charlie. You provided so many unique and well-argued perspectives on your topic. It was like watching a high-stakes debate, and honestly, it was beep awesome. Now let's hear it for Gabby and Ryan as they take us on a journey through food and nature.
Coming to you live, I'll be interviewing Gabby the pig at the factory farm.
In class, we discussed how animals in industrial farms are raised in tiny cages, leaving little room for them to move around. Some farms have over 30,000 animals under one roof at all times. In class, and in the book Porkopolis, we learned both the pig and the cow are at risk of illness if they leave the warehouse at any point, due to their weak immune systems. What is your day-to-day life like as a pig?
Well, I wake up and I don't stretch my legs. Seeing a pig to my left and my right when I look up into the not-really sky, it's a white ceiling and an LED light, but that'll do, I guess. I'm fully aware of my limits of motion, and I usually only take 5 to 10 steps a day.
I see. And I know that factory animals eat corn, wheat, barley, and other protein sources like soybean meal, fish meal, even other animal proteins. And they even feed piglets plasma from their deceased family members. Is this right?
My food has an overall lack of freshness, and I'm not really sure where my things come from. I prefer not to ask.
In addition to the other ingredients that go into the factory animals' food, they also add antibiotics and different medicines to prevent the pigs from getting sicker than they already are, due to the lack of grass in their diet.
The farm workers have to give me medicine in order to stop my upset stomach. It's usually rather constant, and the bloating is so annoying.
In Chapter 5 of Porkopolis by Alex Blanchett, the pig is given growth hormones to help it grow to a suitable size for slaughter. Because of their constant exposure to pharmaceuticals, the runts are often born sick and need immediate medical attention.
They always poke me with a needle, and it gets stuck in my butt. One time, one of my friends needed medical attention for an entire week after she gave birth, and not all of them made it.
And this is a common occurrence, and at the end of this process, the pigs are killed and used without their knowledge. Factory farm animals are corralled into chambers where they are quickly slaughtered, so their stress before death does not affect the quality of the meat.
One day, I wake up, and some of my friends have just disappeared. It's okay, though, because new ones show up.
Oh, wait. Gotta go. The farmer's calling me over. See ya.
Oh, no. I hope she's gonna be okay.
And scene.
As you just listened, that was our segment on my interview with the pig, and we were taken through the day in the life of the pig, as we learned from the book Porkopolis by Alex Blanchett and the book Power Steer by Michael Pollan, where we followed the life of an animal in the factory farm.
And in class, we discussed that we really don't know what happens to pigs on a day-to-day basis. And I think that's really important to also know how our fresh produce got on there, too.
So this is why we took to the Marquee Dining Hall to figure out what students at Lafayette knew about their plates. And coming up, we interviewed Farmer Dan to learn more about La Farm.
I'm Gabby Politi.
And I'm Ryan Ireland.
And this is Eating Agriculturally.
We are coming to you from the FYS 10 Ways to Know Nature. We hope by the end of this episode, you can better understand your plate through the lens of nature.
I can't believe this isn't common knowledge. Everyone should know where their food comes from.
When talking about food in our class, we read The Pleasures of Eating by Wendell Berry. He says eating is an agricultural act.
We're at Marquee Dining Hall with George. George? Do you know where your plate comes from?
The produce comes from the farm, but I don't know where the meat comes from.
Do you know where your plate comes from?
More or less. Not really. And if I was just asked, sometimes I kind of not very clear about what the food is.
Absolutely no idea. I know like some of the vegetables come from the farm, but other than that, no clue.
Honestly, no, not really.
No. Well, but honestly, I see many advertisements in the school saying that our food comes from La Farm. But honestly, is that true?
Yeah, La Farm.
No.
I don't know.
La Farm? Local farms? Do you know where your plate comes from?
La Farm.
Well, at least Lafayette students know that some of the food comes from the farm, but the rest still seems to be a mystery.
Luckily, we do know where the rest of the food in the dining hall comes from after a bit of research on the Lafayette Dining website.
So, 18% of our food comes from Know Your Source vendors.
All pork is verified by where food comes from and is sourced from Clemens Food Group. Their sows are raised in higher welfare group housing without reliance of gestation crate confinement systems.
All beef is sourced and processed domestically, and our ground beef is sourced locally through Happy Valley Meat Co.
We only use hormone-free fluid milk from Harrisburg Dairies.
All shell eggs are cage-free from Crider Farms, and they're third-party verified by American Humane Certified.
Huh. At least Lafayette isn't doing so bad on sustainably sourcing our food.
Yeah, and we can't forget about the portion of our food that is sourced 3 miles down the road from La Farm. Following this, we are going to be having our interview with Farmer Dan, the interim farmer currently filling in for Farmer Josh, who is on paternity leave. We are going to be discussing how La Farm serves Lafayette's culture, our dining halls, and supports our sustainable practices and goals on campus.
Hi, Farmer Dan. Thank you so much for coming on and meeting with us on the phone today. Our first question is talking about compost and wondering where and how that works.
The general understanding is that, you know, there's a bin for compost in the dining halls, and they get picked up by someone from the Office of Sustainability, and then it just gets delivered as a pile, and, you know, has a chance to kind of passively break down at that point, and then it is applied to the beds and becomes, you know, the biomass and nutrients to feed the next crop.
If you're composting food scraps, you're going to be getting some good nutrition for the plants. You know, it's like the principal thing that it's giving back, or what's the actual biomass that's going onto the beds and stuff like that is the leaf litter from the college. And so I would say that, you know, from dining plus the leaf litter, you get a pretty full spectrum of nutrients going on.
In class, you showed us around the farm and helped us compare the dry monocrop soil outside the farm to the rich and diverse soil inside. Can you tell us more about how monocropping affects food quality and the environment?
I mean, the classic critique of monocrop and stuff is that, you know, it becomes something of an ecological dead zone because you're just selecting for this one particular plant to grow and trying to exclude all other, you know, weeds and basically any other biology except for like maybe some fungus and bacteria that would be beneficial in the soil. And you can get a lot of production and sacrifice less land to agriculture, basically.
Yeah, that all makes sense. And how does the relationship between La Farm and the dining hall provide us with the fresh produce from the farm that we get weekly?
Yeah, so Parkhurst is, I guess, the dining service at this point. And yeah, I mean, they make weekly orders. We submit we give them our availability sheet, and then they put in weekly orders. Cinco, Aperfurin, Marquis, and Eco are all ordering from us on a weekly basis. And, you know, some of it's limited by what we have and some of it's limited by what they can use. But seems like it's been, you know, a pretty good mutual relationship there.
What's like an example of one of their orders? Like for say maybe Cinco?
Yeah, you know, when I came in kind of at the tail end of all the summer crops. So we still had, you know, squash and zucchini and tomatoes and peppers and things like that. So it's pretty diverse.
I promise I have one more question. But how does the teaching aspect of the farm, like how are you involved in that? And how do you think that helps inform people on how to know their plate?
You just see like, oh, this part of the plants is the food, or like, you know, there's so much about it. You know, like this is the life cycle of it. These are all the things that have to happen for a pepper plant to actually make a pepper that gets ripe. I feel like just that, you know, kind of raw physical contact over the course of the season with the crops is probably the biggest education, you know, the biggest like educational element. People just get in contact with plants and soil and you know, pollinators and pests and all of that kind of stuff.
I think that's great. And you really summed up our point at the end, like by knowing how a pepper grows. Like we talk about that in our class a lot, about how just like knowing nature and knowing it like intimately. And even though we can't actually know every single process, we can do our best.
Thank you to Farmer Dan for teaching us the benefits of running a sustainable farm.
And to the students at Markey Dining Hall for helping us understand how each and every student at Lafayette knows or doesn't know their plate.
And of course, we can't forget Gabby the pig for running us through a day in her life at the factory farm.
By the way, I was the pig.
Together, each aspect comes together to form what we know as our plate.
Our FYS, 10 Ways to Know Nature, has showed us how to eat agriculturally and to see nature through religion, art, technology, science, and lastly, food.
And now we're going to hand it over to our beloved host, Lily, to wrap us up.
All I can say is, wow, what a finale. Thank you so much, Gabby and Ryan. I was so ignorant to how food was created and processed, especially how the animals are treated before this episode. And a big thanks to all our listeners for joining us today. It's been such an amazing journey exploring nature through the lenses of religion, art, technology, science, and food. I hope you found yourselves thinking about nature in new and unexpected ways.
Remember when I mentioned in the intro that understanding what nature is and how we perceive it is so essential? It really made me reflect on how interconnected our lives are with the natural world. If any of the segments resonated with you or changed your perspective, we'd absolutely love to hear your thoughts. I'd just like to end with a massive thank you to all our incredibly talented speakers for sharing their insights and to all of you for tuning in. If you enjoyed today's episode or learned something new, why not share it with a friend? Let's keep this conversation going. Remember, nature is all around us, just waiting for us to dive deeper and discover more. Thanks so much.